But the real big, one of the big questions I have on this, we've got the Clutton Incorporated versus the federal, and if the state purchases this railroad, we'll have a Clutton Incorporated versus the state. Now, can either one of you gentlemen prophesy, or maybe your crystal ball is better than one I have, who's going to win out on this? Does the Clutton Incorporated and the Native Corporation hold a lesser stance against the federal than they would against the state on this railroad right away?
You got to put it in perspective also, excuse me, in terms of what you're talking about, yourself with the Native claims. If we accept Jackson and Cross's assumption that the value to the railway for these things is measured, is right in their document, at $3.2 million, and the negative value of not having it is $1.8 million, and they've discounted both of them, then is this a very serious question to be even worried about? It is serious from our perspective that we're more concerned about how we're going to operate the railway in the future. Will they have to condemn land just to accomplish this? And that's why we're progressing and trying to settle the Native claims issues with regard to how to operate the railway in the future. We're not there out there to make a profit on it. We're just trying to make a good operating situation in the future. And your pig in the poke approach to the problem is exactly what I outlined earlier, what we're trying to review right now. We've got two things going on, and that's an audit of the last 3 years to see how we can take the last 3 years and project it to you all and say, look, this is what's happened. These are the negatives. This is how long you're going to have negatives. And then also taking the assumptions that USRA has made, ask them to review those assumptions, and with that review, what is the value and what do the cash flows look like? We're answering both those questions. We should have them done by November 31 when we are ready to make our recommendation to the government. I think we could.
If I could add that the right-of-way should really be divorced from some reserve lands, because the right-of-way goes through some of these reserves, but the claims, the Clutonis claims, Eagle River, Birchwood, as a result of the federal bill, only involve the reserve. The right-of-way, the 200-foot right-of-way, if it's 200 in most cases, is to transfer to the state free and clear of these claims unless the corporations relinquish them beforehand. So the federal statute has eliminated a problem with the Native Village Corporations in the right-of-way in terms of the AG's office view and our view.
What about the quarry at Clutton? Now the railroad's been working on for years for fill on the keep-out washout. And it's very important. I mean, you're talking about...
I'm not an expert, and Walsh is not here on the Native claims issue. I don't think we have a problem with the quarry. We're fairly sure of that, isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And this gets back into what Jack was talking about, the reserves, and we do view those as important, the gravel reserves. The question under the law is what was an actual use. The quarry, in fact, was always being used. The problem area is Eagle River, where you have a large parcel of land that's undisturbed, that's being held as a reserve, but was never disturbed. And under the regulations that would apply, if there were a ruling by the federal government, it does not look very favorable that they would find the railroad had that land in actual use, which is one of the reasons, the main reasons, that the negotiation approach makes the most sense, as well as trying to avoid getting into litigation, because it just doesn't.
Well, I have one more question, and I'll shut up, Mr. Chairman. Has it ever been considered, can either one of you gentlemen tell me what it costs to lay 1 mile of track? What can you come up with?
The running price down south, the most recent examples, is well over $1.5 million to almost $2 million a mile. We've estimated out of our Fairbanks office involved in the Canadian extension that in Alaska with the prices at least 2 years ago, you're looking at $2 million a mile or more.
Well, I believe it'd be higher than that, really, in my estimate. But has it ever been considered, instead of extending track, extend conveyor system? Because I believe the only way we're going to make this railroad pay for itself is getting into the mineral fields, and if you want to throw the barley in there, fine, but that's something else. But basically, is the resources into the mineral areas, heavy mineralized areas, for unless you're going to plan on just strictly coal from footprint for, to keep it in the black.
Correct.
Have you considered the conveyor systems on this as an alternate for extension?
Most of the exercise that we're with the transfer team, and we're primarily dealing with the issue of acquisition, question of organization of an entity. Expansion is part of our mandate, but I can't say that the people that are involved in this right now have had the opportunity or time to spend much time looking at that. Made some notes about it.
Thanks.
Representative Phillips.
Now, for the record, I was not supposed to be here till 1 o'clock this afternoon. I have a question on, and I know I missed probably about three quarters of your statement, but I do have a concern about the employees and their retirement system. And I don't, this report, this for your information, I read, I just received this 2 days ago. I read this and this one here, and this may be about 30 pages here as far as I got in the last couple of days. But this report's in September of this year, and I want to find out if there's anything new since this report relating to the employees
in
relating to their
retirement.
Right.
There is some new information, so much on the numbers of what the problem is. We now have the state's actuary firm under Department of Administration trying to reconcile one federal agency, Office of Personnel Management, estimated the problem to be a certain number. USRA took it into account in their valuation. They have a little different sense of what that number is. Our state people are, as part of our exercise by the end of November, going to help us get that, pin that number down. At the same time, we've started an effort with the Federal Office of Personnel Management with a letter from the governor to that director, and then we're talking to our delegation to get their assistance to obtain a more favorable ruling. I don't know if you got to the part in the, I think it's Article 6 of that report.
No.
On page 60, when you get there, you'll, the basic issue under the two options for the transfer for retirement people, for the retirement system of the employees, and under option one, we take the railroad, we take the employees, we leave them in the federal system for purposes of retirement. Today, what that is the railroad makes 7% contribution and employees make a 7% contribution. What the Office of Personnel Management has told the state is that once transferred, the state's going to have to make up a difference for an unfunded problem of another 22%, which is where the problem comes from. We have found three or four agencies that transferred under similar situations as us, same language. They weren't asked to do this. We feel the precedent's on our side. When this was worked on, legislative history's on our side, that all we were supposed to have to do is continue to pay the 7%. We've talked to the OPM people. They say it is discretionary, but the time has come for people to start picking this up, and we're choosing you. We're working on a negotiation basis to get a more favorable reading. Hopefully back to the 7% level. If not, there seems to be some maneuvering between having to pay the 22%.
Some follow-up here. Oh, and when is this favorable, well, not the favorable reading, when is this follow-up going to come when we,
we're
with some certainty that we're going to know what the numbers are as the number of employees, that what the retirement system is going to cost, if it's going to cost the state or somebody else is going to pick it up, and so on and so forth.
Our goal is to have that number most definitely by end of November.
Okay.
And a good reading out of OPM by the end of November.
So it'll be all before we head down to June again.
Now, it's fair to make sure it's understood. The OPM issue may take a little longer to work.
Yeah.
And it may be in our interest to not rush it. But we're, because we feel that y'all have to know that before January.
Well, to me, that's a pretty vital question in the whole equation, whether the state should take the railroad or not, or somebody else, or some other authority. That's important, because without the employees, you can't run the railroad.
I think the worst assumption has been cranked into the valuation. Is not
really it is fair to say that having to pay the full additional amount was what created that orange bar of the cash flow.
Oh.
So it is in
it's
the
worked
it's worked
the
in.
Yeah, I was worried about the retirement.
But that's worked in.
That's worked in.
Okay.
Yeah.
You missed that. All these costs that we're talking about, including the settlement costs, are worked into the negative.
Okay, I didn't see this.
Part of
so it's deducted from the price of the railroad.
Randy, if you on page 26 of the it's table 3 of the ESSER report. you have about halfway down a column that's titled startup costs. Pensions, code conformity. What they've done in the cash flow is on a negative basis, added in the annual, this is all in constant dollars, annual increased contribution that the state would have to meet, assuming we had to pick up this 22% problem, starting at 4.5 million, and it decreases because you have fewer people in the system, and that is run out 10 years, and then they ran out beyond that in terms of terminal value. So they have factored in the increased cost to the state as opposed to the federal government on a yearly basis, and that number, it totally jives with the number we have, that first one.
Okay. Mine, you only had about 2 days to speed read.
Representative Ward?
Yes, I'd like to follow up somewhat on your money thing there. Commissioner Casey, I think it was Commissioner Casey, and Peter McDowell mentioned to Budget and Audit, and if I recall right, that there's a possibility of the federal government and the state government and these various disputed native claims of going into some form of a land exchange agreement, which would, and the military, and the military is requiring more military ground, but a possibility of all these entities going into a land exchange, which would then eliminate or at least reduce the amount of cash money that that would have to be appropriated for the purchase of this. Are you familiar with that? Can you tell me more about it? Because it was a very brief statement, but I found it very intriguing that somebody is, and then I noticed it's alluded to throughout here according to whichever one it hits.
Yeah, I think I can help in that. The native claim parcels probably ought to be taken out, though, because that's really not tied to this.
The military, then.
What we're talking about is that the under the statute says we have to compensate the federal government. Now they've come up with a price tag. There's nothing in the statute says the form that compensation is supposed to take. It's supposed to be all cash right away, spread out over some years, or some type of in-kind value-reducing quid pro quo of some type.
Firstborn.
Right. And we talked to the U.S. Department of Transportation. They're in the driver's seat on the federal side. They feel they have latitude to talk about this, some alternatives to having the state right off the bat put $22.3 million on the table. One of the issues I think Commissioner Casey was speaking to is that the in the case of Elmendorf and Richardson primarily, they have a 30 or 40 mile right-of-way that goes through there, that under the transfer statute, one could read it to say we could put snowmobile tracks and bicycle trails and all sorts of things through that right-of-way because we do take it in fee. I appreciate that has military a little disturbed about being able to perform their mission in security, and they have sensitive areas, and they have asked us for some type of limitation in those areas, and it's something which seems a reasonable concern that we've been told by, including Senator Stevens, but others, that Congress would have dealt with this if the military ever came to them. They just never did in the bill, and that there needs to be some accommodation in exchange that we can attach some value to limiting snowmobile trails and bicycle trails, for example. I'm not sure anybody's interested in citing those in those areas. And if that's possible and a value can be assigned, then the price tag might be able to be reduced because the state has given up something, an in-kind value. That's an example of the kind of thing that's being looked at. Our hope is to have that together also by the end of November.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, then a possibility of even expanding on that to other forms of federal participation in land ownership, because the federal government, besides military, does want lands that the state happen to end up with, and vice versa. But it's I'm wondering if that formula will be considered more so than the money part, or at least as much.
It is being considered. The direction we've had, though, in terms of the obviously there are a lot of other non-related railroad land issues. Department of Interior has a whole list. Environmental groups have a whole list of state inholdings in places that they'd like to see moved out of state ownership. And our direction is to be sensitive to that, but if at all possible, avoid the kind of arrangement that would trigger a land swap. That makes a lot more sense to look. We're dealing with $22 million, and if we get into some of these inholdings, they're worth a lot more than that, probably. And it makes more sense to try and find some arrangements, such as the one I just described, or another one is that the military yearly performs their brim frost exercises. A simple permit, they want to expand that, they'd like it on a more long-term basis. We give it to them for free right now. It seems it's one of the things we're talking to them about, to give them some certainty about the availability of, it's the Galkana Glacier, I guess, 30 or 40 year basis, some type of in-kind reduction of value. Those are the ones that we're really trying to look at more than straight land swaps.
Certain amount of credit in terms of the freight that's hauled for the federal government. It's not that significant, but it is worth some capitalized value.
If I may, then I'm glad to see that that's under discussion, because my understanding is that there's a road that's supposed to go to the Connect Bridge at the military seems to have a little problem with right now, and maybe that could come up through the various discussions. That'd be nice.
Representative Booth,
my plug's in. I can't help it.
In the event a private carrier bids on the railroad, let's assume for a moment that they won it, would they have to conform to the same retirement benefits as the state federal arrangement? Or could they just buy the railroad, get their own people in, do anything they want to do?
That's one of the unknowns. The federal statute doesn't tell you one way or the other. It would be primarily up to the Secretary of Transportation, since she's the one that's carries the ball at that point to run the process.
But
the people that have looked at it on a legal basis, all these protection provisions are part of the same statute. And it seems that if transportation didn't do it, the unions could force all these provisions to be part of the package that these people would have to bid on.
But then in the same token, if that were to occur, we're the ones that would be losing, because it would be in negotiations, it would be in union problems with that private carrier, etc. Would it not? And that railroad might stop if they haven't got anybody to run it because of the conflict there, whereas the state is being required to pick up those people, right? And that's a big cost factor. And then
I'm
going
lost to on the question, I guess.
Sir?
So I'm a little lost on the question.
I guess, well, let's see. I guess the question is, why doesn't private industry then, in other words, if private industry were to get the railroad and didn't have to conform to these regulations that the feds have already established by stating, you will, state of Alaska, pick up the retirement from those federal workers on the railroad. If they didn't have to do it, let's say they bid and won the bid, at that time, is that the time that the secretary would make a decision whether or not they have to pay the employees or not?
No, I think that would have to be part of the bid package.
Part of the bid package.
They'd have to answer that question up front.
I think
transportation,
so.
In my view.
Representative Blocker?
Well, I kind of see this, if I can bring it down. Not many of us have ever been involved in buying a railroad before, so I'd like to bring this back down to things that we do know about. I see this as an agreement to purchase that hasn't been signed by the state of Alaska and the federal government. And should we decline, then and only then is it open. And then it would probably go out on some sort of bid specs would go out on what it would be available to the private enterprise. It could be at three times the price, at half the price, all different kinds of conditions, different than the ones that's been offered to us. And so basically that's what it is. And I think what Representative McBride said is especially important. The only reason why we're involved here is because somebody somewhere thought a long time ago that this railroad was important to the state. If it's important to the state, what is it that its people want? And then I hope that we can decide that maybe private enterprise can provide that better than the state government. But if it is state government, then is best able to provide it, then how are we going to do it? And I'm especially concerned about the fact that this transportation committee doesn't have a bill drafted yet. And that's really where I'm coming from and where I hope we'll go today.
have fun. Representative Liska.
I've got, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got, are you through, Mitch? Did you have any more?
No, you got four.
In your hand, go. Has anybody studied this out as to, the statement was made, by, I believe, by you, sir, that the federal government wanted to get rid of the railroad. They didn't want to be in a railroad business. It's not a good idea anyway for any government to be involved in a business which is interfering with private enterprise. So what we're going to do here, if the state purchases this railroad, the state government will own a railroad, and they'll have the whole trucking industry involved in the railroad running competition with the Alaska truckers. So to me, this is a problem that's going to have to be addressed eventually, because under the Brim process mentioned, that could be here this year and gone next year, military exercise. I don't think we can hang anything on that to be permanent. But if the state of Alaska ends up purchasing a railroad, believe me, because I know we have problems in ATC right now that are just a whole bunch of them. This is just going to add more problems to the fire, because here the state owned the railroad is going to be shipping buku freight, which the truckers would be hauling. So whether we want to admit it or not, it is a problem we have to address. It's going to come up. So I just toss that out for what it's worth, because it's going to be there.
As long as the state's not in the subsidy and it keeps the railway as an entity to make a profit, it's not going to, and you don't provide it with a subsidy, then it's going to be in competition with the truckers, but it should be relatively fair competition, because it's not going to lower the rates below a break even if you're required to make a profit and if you operate as a profitable entity from a state point of view.
If I could add, and there are other considerations as well, the trucking industry in the form of the highway maintenance system and rehabilitation, the road system, dredging the Port of Anchorage enjoys implicit subsidies. There's all sorts of studies that show that the gas tax payments that they make by no means cover the real cost of the damage which they perform in the road system. So there's that consideration in terms of the offset. The other thing is that the railroad is involved in an awful lot of commodities, bulk commodities of coal and sand and gravel. It's not at all clear that the trucking industry would be the alternative to haul that kind of commodity. There are several areas where they are in a competition mode with the trucking industry, but there's an awful lot of other commodities that the railroad is able to move much more efficiently in a bulk sense.
Well, the federal government today is involved in hauling gravel from the pits at Palmer. There's a typical example right there of what you're trying to say, I believe. But that's just one.
I think one of the things I would suggest you probably look at is if that was all trucked, what are the whether that would in fact happen, whether the economics would be there, and if it did, what would happen to the road system between here and Eagle River and Palmer. That type of tonnage, I think it's up to about $3 million a year in sand and gravel across that road system would increase road maintenance costs, I think, dramatically, and rehabilitation.
Probably true.
Representative Coburn.
Thank you. Now, I was going to bring up that point. I think this last session we did discuss road maintenance, and it appeared that gas tax is only about 10% of the maintenance cost. For the rest is a subsidy private automobile and trucking. And I can remember when the bulk of the gravel in Anchorage was moved at great speed and little regard for public safety of the roads by trucks barreling South Fairbanks. In fact, I had a friend killed by being overrun. But it doesn't seem that we can escape from subsidizing some sector of the economy. In this case, we are subsidizing trucking, and because it's a necessary economic function, we have to maintain the roads for them, and we can't expect that they are going to be able to pay the cost. Likewise, we made the choice when the Alaska Communication System, which was a federal system, went on the block, The state at that time did not bid on it. It made no commitments. It went to private enterprise, to RCA originally, and then Alascom, which is Portland Power and Light, I believe, at this point. But the state has picked up the cost of the ground stations. It has paid part of the cost of the satellite. It has essentially put as much into our telecommunication system as a subsidy to the operator and to the communities that were served, the isolated communities in Alaska, and also those who want to watch football in prime time, as if we were operating the system ourselves. It doesn't seem to be that one way or the other we escape the necessity of figuring out how much we're going to put into that as our share of it. We can be a little tight-fisted about it sometimes, but it doesn't seem realistic to assume that that the costs are going to be absorbed by somebody else. We're going to have to kick in on some bit of it.
Representative Ward.
Yes, this is kind of unrelated, but back when the first discussion, or some of, but 3 years ago, there were discussions about the purchasing of the Alaska Railroad and taking over the Alaska Railroad by the state of Alaska from the federal government. And at that time, and I asked for this once before, and it apparently is under a government, a federal government instead of state government, but there was a study done by the railroad at that time tying into what it would cost to electrify if Susitna was built, the Alaska Railroad. And I was wondering, not that I don't expect, but if you could possibly in your wanderings maybe come across that and issue it to the chairman of this committee, I would like to see it. I remember it was very startling, and it was seemed like a terrific plan, but then I never heard about it again. And the federal government spent $500,000 on it, my understanding was, and then it was gone. But it was about 3 years ago, three, 4 years ago.
I've heard of the same study. I've never been able to uncover it. I know from looking at it in terms of other studies, it would be astronomical, the cost to at least look at electrification of the entire line. You might be able to, on a segment basis, bring it more into something you could get a handle on, but we'll certainly take a look and try and get it for you, but it's up there.
Okay.
As to what it would cost.
All right, thank you.
Sure.
At this time, it's moving on to 12 o'clock, and these gentlemen do have a prior engagement with Commonwealth North, I believe. And I'd like to honor the commitment that I made to them earlier that we would break and let them be able to do that. Part of the purpose of this meeting is that we as a committee and we as a legislature have to ask ourselves some questions. First question we have to ask ourselves, do we want the railroad? If we answer yes, then we've got to decide why we want the railroad. And then to go on beyond that, we're just going to have to ask ourselves, what do we want the railroad to do? Once we, you know, what is the main function do we want the railroad to accomplish? Then to even go deeper to financing question, how do we want to finance it? How do we want to buy it? Do we want to outlays of capital funds, state dollars, or do we want to set up maybe a public corporation where we can get people buying shares into it and having a say into the operation of the railroad? And receiving back a portion of the profit, if there is a profit or if there ever will be a profit. It's a question that we all have to ask. So I'd like to reconvene at 1:30, and at the time, there is at least one person that would like to have public testimony, I believe from the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. So I would like to take his testimony at that time. And then I would like to go back to Mr. Hickey and Mr. Day if they have any further presentation or if there is any further questions of them at that time after the public testimony. So therefore, we'll recess as a committee until 1:30.
chairman of the Anchorage, or I'm sorry, the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce Transportation Committee. I'm a volunteer. I'm not paid in any way. I'm coming as a private citizen to give you some comments from the citizen sector. I've made a number of notes from this morning's discussions, and I hope I would like to cover as many of those as possible. The State Chamber of Commerce has been reviewing the railroad transfer and legislation for over 2.5 years, and I don't have any prepared comments, but I would like to talk to you from a speech that I gave to the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce convention in Sitka last month, and I do have copies if anybody's interested. So if you will allow me, I'd like to make some off-the-cuff comments. One of the things I'd like to address is the question that was posed this morning of whether the state should take on the railroad, whether the state should indeed purchase the railroad. Maybe I see things much more simpler than they might be, but speaking from the annual report of the railroad, I don't see how that can be a question. The railroad provides such a tremendous service to the rail belt in terms of providing freight movement. If I can just point out to you from their annual report, this is the 82 annual report because the 83 is still in printing, but the railroad delivered 2.7 million tons of sand and gravel, 650,000 tons of coal, 440,000 tons of petroleum products, 450,000 tons of manufactured goods, 122 tons of piggybacks, 77 tons of forest products, and 7,000 tons of agricultural products. I really don't understand how the legislature can say they wonder whether they should accept the railroad. I say that knowing full well that I also believe that the federal government is not going to operate the railroad, that if they see that the state of Alaska does not want to accept the railroad, that they indeed will go forward in accordance with the Transfer Act and put it on the block, as the term I believe that's being used. Now, that's a twofold process. The putting it on the block involves giving a priority to anyone who would agree to operate the railroad. That's the first priority. If there is no one who is willing to do that, the second option under that putting on the block is to sell the railroad piecemeal if necessary. And I'm sure you're all aware that Senator Stevens has said that that is a real possibility. Now, I can't support this figure, but I have been told that the value of the railroad piecemeal is about $400,000, a little over $400,000.
$400,000?
Yes, that's taking the railroad, taking the locomotives, the track, the everything else, and selling it. Now, the counter to that is that the market for that is very, very soft. I think it was mentioned this morning by Mr. Hickey that the lower 48 railroads are in a surplus situation. In fact, this railroad up in Alaska has been able to buy at a tremendous discounts equipment. So whether that's not a hard number is what I'm suggesting, but it's worth quite a bit of money if you sell it piecemeal. I would like to point out too, just for the record, and I would suggest that that you look into this annual report, even though it is an 82 report, that the railroad for the past 3 years has shown a surplus. I don't use the term profit because of the way they account for their monies, that it is not called profit because it is a federal agency, and they're required to report in ICC accounting procedures, and they indicate it as a surplus. But for 1983, their net surplus will be about $7.3 million. 1982, it was $6.5 million. And in 1981, it was $400,000. and in 1980 they showed a loss.
If you mind, do you mind if members break in and ask you?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Please.
I just wanted to clear up something, and I think maybe you made an error, and this is on tape, so if it is, we should have it corrected. You said the railroad's worth was $400,000. Do you not mean $400 million?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I certainly did. Thank you, Jack.
That's what I was trying to get at.
I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
$400 million.
I slipped some decimals, and it's disastrous sometimes. $400 million. That's right. Thank you, Jack. Appreciate that. But let me point out that for the 3 years previous to those 3 years I just mentioned, they did show significant losses in operations.
And I believe, if I can interrupt, that that is from the beginning of the railroad up until these 3 years, they have suffered the losses, not that
good. No, they've been, yeah, it's been.
Well, everything I've looked at has shown.
No, I've seen some historical figures. I don't have them here with me today, but at times during the pipeline construction, they showed tremendous increases. 75, 74 were big profit years or surplus years.
Well, I think when I saw it, said except during pipeline years.
Okay.
But I think it lost some money.
Except during pipeline years.
Yes, it did. It lost $7 million in 80.
Okay.
Yes.
And during the war period, too.
Yeah.
Tremendous. I think wore the entire physical plant down to nothing.
Right. I think what it shows is the railroad is a high volume bulk hauler, and that's how they make their money. They don't make much money, for instance, hauling gravel from Palmer to Anchorage. They would make much more money if they hauled that same gravel from Fairbanks to Anchorage, because they're paid on a mile basis. I mean, they negotiate in different ways, and it's very complex, but in general, they get paid for hauling volumes of material. I do want to hit a note, I think, that was brought up by Representative Blocker, that I believe, in my personal experience in studying the railroad and talking to many people, that deferred maintenance is has become a myth. And the USRA, when they were up here analyzing the railroad, they were asked to look at deferred maintenance, and they did on a fairly quick basis. They didn't go over each mile of track, but I need to state this clearly so you don't misunderstand, but our railroad, the Alaska Railroad, is at a level of maintenance that it needs to be for the volume of freight that it hauls. There is no deferred maintenance. They are maintaining it at a level that it needs to be. I think one of the most, there are several, let me qualify that to say that there are two areas, for instance, that are several areas of the railroad that could use a large capital infusion of money to correct some slope grade deficiencies of the track. Healy Canyon, there's a continual maintenance problem at that area that requires a lot of money. That could be fixed one time and then be done with it. But in general, there is no deferred maintenance. And the USRA director, when he was up here, made the statement. He said, I wish I had some of my tracks in Lower 48 on a comparable load basis the same as you have your railroad.
What does that mean? I mean, they have a heavier load than we do?
Well, yes, for the comparable.
Okay.
You don't over-design a railroad. You don't design a track and ties and ballast to carry an 80-mile gravel train if you're only going to go 30 miles and only cover that track twice a day.
Deferred maintenance doesn't even relate to design and
building. Oh, it does.
But not the deferred maintenance that I'm talking about. When you're able to change on the books the ratio of expense to income, I have to start looking for how that happened.
But they didn't, I don't think.
That they're doing a study, and that what they've been able to find out so far is that there's a possibility that some of that is responsible for that change in ratio.
I guess I'm sorry I brought up the
consideration
of design, because it. But there is no sense in maintaining a track system in excess of what its load capable rates might be.
What do you have to back that up? I mean, I need facts and figures that, that this was overbuilt.
No, no, no. I'm not coming across to you.
You're right. You're right.
If I just break in for a second, I would like to at this time say that we also have an attendant, Senator Moss, who is chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee, which has been involved quite heavily in the railroad hearing. And I would also like to invite Senator Moss to the table and have him feel free to ask questions also.
I've got to go down to an REA meeting. That's why I didn't want to get too enthused. And I'm really enthused at what you're doing there, Mr. Chairman, and appreciate the opportunity. But I didn't want to break it off here. This is about the time I got really in. I'll be down and then back up here.
Oh, okay. So feel free to join whenever.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you, Jim. Go ahead with
it. If I could, it's a speed and load kind of thing.
I understand that part.
And there are many areas, especially in the northern part of the railroad, where they held the speed restrictions because of the lightness of the rail or the lightness of the ballast. And to go the next step up would be, require capital infusion, not just maintenance. So
it would hardly be called deferred maintenance because you didn't go that other step up, is what I'm saying. Right. I mean, I've never bought a railroad before, but I know a little something about deferred maintenance. And changing ratios.
Representative Locker, I'm sure you do. But I guess I would ask you, do you have facts to show that maintenance was deferred?
No. I was hoping this man would have that. And well, he told me, he's right here, that he doesn't have them either, that there's being a research done.
I think I've got them here. 1982 annual report.
Well, that's in your judgment.
Yes, in my judgment.
Thank you.
That if they list in here the various maintenance items, and they list them for back to 1978, and I'm sure if you got other annual reports that there would be other items showing that. So I would offer to the committee that you may want to get copies of this and review this in your debate.
And Mr. Chairman, we may want to speak to the manager of the railroad, if that's a question that other people are interested in.
That's a good idea. let me go on if I might, and again I'm kind of trying to touch some topics that were covered this morning. Is Representative Liska, and I'm sorry he's not here this afternoon because I wanted to make sure I felt the point that I was trying to get across. The railroad and the truckers are definitely in competition, but it's a very select kind of competition. As was pointed out by Mr. Hickey, that the railroad hauls bulk quantities, obviously a lot faster and easier than, say, the truckers might be able to haul the gravel from Palmer. That probably wouldn't be feasible by truck. But on the other hand, ask yourself if you would not want that competition between truckers and would just have the access of the use of trucks. It would not be feasible to haul all the quantities that I listed previously. It's just not feasible by truck. There aren't enough trucks, they're not large enough, and we don't have the highways to get where they need to get to go. The other point in that issue I would like to point out is that the railroad is required to operate under ICC regulations, which have a lot of controls. So I would like to bring those two points to that issue. The other topic I wanted to talk about is private purchase. I think Representative Abood brought that out, and it's certainly an excellent question. In some of my informal discussions with one particular private entity which has railroad experience, they are not ready to come to talk to the state because there's so many issues that are still hanging out there waiting to fall on them, they feel. They would like to see many of these things resolved before they step into the picture, and realize also that an outright purchase of the railroad isn't really feasible if you think about it in terms of a private operator having to purchase the land and track. It's just totally without reason. There's no way you could operate the railroad and recoup that kind of capital. So we have tried to take that fact into account in a proposal, which I will talk to you later about.
Yes, you tell me a couple of things. So far, I've heard that we should buy the railroad. You think we should buy the railroad. Now, don't forget, I'm not anti-railroad.
I understand.
But all the only thing I've heard so far is gravel, coal. During the times of the oil revenues or the oil being shipped, the oil. What happens if we don't have any more oil? What happens, I'm looking down the road, we don't have any more gravel. Or where are we going to pull the gravel to? I know the gravel the shipping has been increased about, God, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 fold maybe. They've had to go in and redo some of the rail beds in order to hold the loads. They're running 80 cars.
That's true.
8 or 10, 15, 17, 18 times a day. It's constantly running back. I know because I live near the railroad, and that house of mine just here, I can tell you when one's coming long before I hear him. So I know that they're putting it, they're pulling a terrible amount of gravel. Well, okay, so they don't need the gravel anymore. What's going to support the railroad if we don't have coal, we don't have gravel, we don't have oil? We certainly are not going to do it because of the grain. What other things were mentioned? And then we're talking about, at the good times, it made money. Average times, it didn't. What is going to support that other than private industry? Now you tell me, private industry can't take care of the, can't buy the ground or the right-of-ways and all the rest of it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's absolutely mandatory then that either the state buy it or nobody buys it, because you're telling me they cannot afford to do it.
No, sir, if I can respond, that's not what I'm suggesting. If you'd like, I'll go into my recommendation, I guess, if you can call it, and I will, just to answer your question. What the State Chamber of Commerce is proposing is that the state maintain, or is the state own all of the land and track facilities, that the state hold that in perpetuity, not give that up. That is a tremendous resource. And furthermore, that the state would be responsible through one of its line agencies, probably DOT, it's most practical, to be responsible for all expansions and construction of all expansions, design and construction of expansions. Once these expansions and the existing right-of-way are brought together, that a public authority or some of the other concepts that Mr. Hickey's brought out be established such that a private operator can operate on those right-of-ways. And that's how you can bring a private operator into the arena, have him perform the best duties that he's able to, which is on a profit incentive, and still allow the state to maintain a public entity, which is required under the Federal Transfer Act. And that's our proposal in a nutshell.
Would you go into business with the state under those circumstances, that the state tells you this is what you're going to do, and either you do it that way or you don't be the entity to run the railroad per se? We own it, private industry runs it.
I think that's a perfectly acceptable way. Under a lease operator contract, that the private operator knows exactly what he's required to do, he knows the conditions under which he has to work, and he knows what arena he's dealing with. And as long as you don't change the rules on him, I think it's perfectly legitimate.
You probably hit the key statement. Provided,
well, if it's
you
in a
don't
contract,
change the rules.
If it's in
the
a
state's
contract,
been known right down the line, and you know it, about changing the rules when they want something done the way they want it done, not
that's
the
right
way somebody else, private industry, does it.
That's right. But we feel our suggestion is at least a viable method to consider in operating the railroad and excluding it from the political arena and making it a viable business entity. Now, I might add, let me quickly interject that we also strongly support passenger service. And one of the numbers I didn't mention in here to you, that the railroad hauled something like 175,000 passengers last year, a good part of those tourists, and that promotes our tourist industry. And that service may have to be subsidized by the state, because typically passenger service is a loss. But that should be fairly minor. And we strongly support passenger service on the railroad.
Maybe I'm getting into your recommendations, but what I hear you saying is okay, the state should retain the ownership, sovereign ownership of the railroad, contract somebody out for maybe 10, 20 years or maybe a shorter term contracts to run and maintain that railroad, I guess is what you're saying.
That's right. Under the federal registration, if I can,
okay,
it's required that the railroad be a state entity. Mm. And it must be operated as a railroad. That's a foregone conclusion. But But there is a requirement under federal legislation that has to happen, Randy, so.
Okay, I won't, right, that's on. Another question I'm gonna ask you, but I think I'd rather wait for your other recommendations, because you might answer it.
Okay, Representative Bryan.
You know, again, it kind of goes back to what I said this morning. There's a whole number of reasons why the state would want to get involved in the railroad. And then we get to the point, and I just think that we ought to think about this in making our decisions, is we get to the point where we're saying that if at all possible, we want a private industry entity to take this over, and obviously they want to make a profit. And if we don't ask ourselves why we want that railroad and what our goals are, and you mentioned just one, is tourism. Now, tourism obviously has economic effects to the rest of the state, and it doesn't do anything for the private entity that's trying to run it and make a profit. We very well may want to make a point of that they have to haul passengers on certain lines or at certain times. Our agriculture business, we're trying to build up within the state. The railroad could be a very important part of that, but it may not make a profit for anybody. We have to know those things. And so there's a whole number of reasons that we should be looking at of why we want it. We may want to run the railroad just because it's going to cost more to keep the roadbed up if we ran trucks. And that's an economic value to the state. So, you know, I think we can't get away from asking ourselves why we want it and what the policy and the goals are going to be, and then fit that within, if a public or a private entity fits into that, and we may very well have to subsidize some of that for our own good reasons to make that work. So I think it goes back to more and more you see why you have to know why you want it and what you're going to do with it.
Who's going to run it?
And then who's going to run it?
In other words, you're saying to set up the agenda, what the reasons why you want it.
Yeah.
And the time, Mr. Chairman, the time element is running out. We've got July. And I've sat in more than one meeting on this railroad. I've been involved in it for 2 years, and so has Randy. We keep coming up with the same questions. We're not getting the right kind of answers to make us to say yes. Maybe we ought to say, forget the reasons why. It's available. Let's the state buy it and run it, regardless of how much money it costs us. Maybe we ought to do it that way. But then again, we've got some repercussions along those lines.
If I can respond, the railroad is an existing operating entity. And while it can be made more efficient, obviously, any organization can, that there are existing inherent advantages into its existing operation without the legislature meddling with it at all, say. So I think maybe the debate is not so much whether we should accept the railroad, but more where should the railroad be going? And that's a long-term question that you don't need to answer by July 14th of 84. You can spend a lot of time, and it should be a lot of time spent on that question, as opposed to should we buy it and how should we operate it.
Okay, you say from this point on, where should the railroad should go? I also think it's important to find out why the railroad was first established and look in the past to make a judgment call for the future. And I've been doing a lot of reading lately, but I read Ernest Greening's book, The History of Alaska, and I think it was Judge Wickersham who originally put the original appropriation in to start the railroad. And the reason for starting the railroad was cheaper transportation costs of goods coming in and out of the state, plus accessibility. I don't think we ought to miss the past.
Very much so.
And I think some of those needs are still there for the future.
Very much so. The federal government actually provided seed money, and that's what it was. It was a new enterprise.
But wasn't that, going back to what I said a few minutes ago, for World War II?
Yeah.
To haul freight, to get it up here, to do the things to protect our country with. Now then, be that the case on that one instance, that was a specialized reason for the railroad, because there were no roads. But the problem that I have with, I don't have a problem, just a matter of conversation, I think, that every time we talk about how the railroad is making money, we're talking about a huge project like the pipeline. Now all of a sudden, who's buying all this gravel we're hauling anyway? Where is the gravel going? It seems to me once in a while that I think they're hauling it up to this Fairbanks, and then they're hauling it back down, you know? Like in the service, dig a hole here, dig another hole, fill it back in again. And I don't know where we're going with it. What are we doing with the gravel? Why is it necessary to haul all this gravel?
We don't have any.
Because, you know?
Yes, I think I know.
Sure.
The gravel is being used to develop Anchorage. All the construction you see, all the new roads that the legislature appropriated, no, that was federal funds, to build the Minnesota Extension, it's all gravel hauled in from Palmer. All the buildings that you see, the price of gravel, if that were not being hauled in, would be astronomically high because Anchorage has been built on its gravel pits. You might be interested to know that the gravel now that is being hauled in by the railroad, a competitor can see. He's attempting to see if it's feasible to bring gravel in by barge to the Anchorage port, because such a gravel demand is being made here in Anchorage because of the way our growth is going. But if I can comment, Mitch, a little bit on the railroad is the future of the state of Alaska if you consider us a natural resource state. And if we're going to be part of the Pacific Rim, if we want to broaden our revenue base from just oil and forest products, Cominco up at Red Dog Mine is a perfect example of a railroad use. If the state, and I'm not making this a proposal, but if the state could see their way clear to take the capital to build a railroad on that road that they're proposing to a port and allow that to be paid back by revenues, I think you'd see a very viable operation just with the Red Dog Mine.
No question of that, but when they're shutting down mines in Canada on lead and zinc, what are we doing in the lead and zinc business?
That's the point. You're not in the lead and zinc business. That is a private operation. Mm-hmm. It's a private operation whereby the private owner is willing to put up his capital, and all you're doing is providing a transportation link, which the monies would be repaid in revenues from the mine. That's his risk, not yours.
Oh, I understand that, but if he hasn't got a market for the lead and the zinc that's coming out of the mine, what does he need transportation for? He can't sell it. It's got to go to the marketplace.
But that's right, but he does. As I understand it, they do or will have.
It's a very uncompetitive market. Not so it may not be in 10 years, but right now it's not competitive. According to what I read, anyway.
I've had some discussions, and I will just draw on that from memory, but I understand that's a very viable and very rich operation. And there's other enterprises in the state. I don't want to belabor the point, but the other issue is the 800,000 tons of coal that we have a contract, the state has a contract with, or I shouldn't say the state, the Usabelli mine, that coalition of companies have a contract to sell to Sunil in Korea. Now that's a 15-year contract. That's 800,000 tons of coal a year going out of Seward. That port can handle 4 million tons a year, which tells me that there's going to be many other Far East Pacific Rim operators looking at the capability of hauling coal from Alaska. That's a tremendous resource that we have to sell. It's a viable resource. It's a profit-making resource. It creates a lot of jobs. It produces a lot of taxes. And that, I believe, ultimately, over the years, that capacity, that port will be met. That 800,000 tons a year is going to bring in the revenue to the railroad of about $10 million a year. And if you put $10 million gross revenue coming into the railroad of that kind of money, that's another plug to why the railroad can do well over a period of years. Oil is not going to run out in this state. Resources are not going to run out in this state. They're only limited by